Hey, everybody, this is Chuck Marone. Today's podcast is with one of our members, and I want to let you know real quick how this came about. We started on the blog a member blog role. We realized that a lot of our members do some great writing. We've actually brought some of them in to write on our blog occasionally, but we know that they maintain their own blogs and there's some really good stuff going on out there. And so we put out a call for member blog roles. If anybody out there in Strong Towns world is maintaining a blog, send us the link and we will put it on our page and we'll pump that feed out and let other people see the good work that you're doing. That's been an overwhelming success and we've had a lot of people send us good stuff and we're looking for ways to kind of promote that and get that kind of front and center because there's a lot of great work going on out there. I want to let you know about it, not only so you can go there and get some of those resources, but also, you know, if you have a blog yourself, if you're someone who's out there putting out content and you want to be able to share it, go to Strong Towns, become a member, share the link with us. Strongtowns.us is the site to do that. We would love to include your work in what we do and with the people that listen to and read our stuff. Become a member, strongtowns.us. Thanks for listening, everybody, and enjoy the show. You're listening to the Strong Towns Podcast. Hey, everybody, this is Chuck Marone. Welcome back to the Strong Towns Podcast. This week, I've got Sally Phlox on the line. Sally's the president and CEO of PEDS, an advocacy organization dedicated to making Metro Atlanta safe and accessible for all pedestrians. Sally had previously served on the board of directors of America Walks and on the steering committees of Complete Streets and the Safe Routes to School National Partnership. Sally, welcome to the Strong Towns Podcast.
Thank you.
It's wonderful to have you here. You became a member of Strong Towns, and that's actually how I came across your work. First of all, thank you for being a member.
Well, I love reading the articles and blogs that you send, so I've learned a lot.
That's very kind. PEDS stands for Pedestrians Educating Drivers on Safety. Let's talk a little bit about how you got involved in pedestrian advocacy and driver education. I think it's a fascinating story that it would be a good way to start this conversation.
Well, 6 months after I moved to Atlanta in the late 70s, I was diagnosed with epilepsy and told to quit driving. Getting around Atlanta without a car is difficult. Fortunately,
that's one way to put it.
Well, especially if you live in the suburbs, but I live in the upper part of Midtown. Midtown is now one of the most walkable areas in the region. It's really dedicated now to focused on high-rise development, mixed use, and it's become a really vibrant area. And I live on the north end of that in what is actually the first suburb that was built for automobiles. The streets are really wide. They were designed for horse and buggy side by side with cars. It's 110 years old, the neighborhood. But it's still close enough that I can walk to work, walk to transit, and now that the Midtown area is revitalized, pretty much walk to all the retail I need. But I started PEDS back in 1996. I had gotten off the bus and needed to cross the street to get back to street I live on, and drivers were cutting me off in the crosswalk, turning left and turning right out of my neighborhood. And this had happened to me many times before, kind of getting trapped in the crosswalk when I had the walk light. And at the time I was taking a writing workshop, planning to become a freelance writer, and we had to write something and read it to the group every week. And so I decided to write an op-ed on a pedestrian right-of-way. I come from California where people did respect pedestrians in the crosswalks, and I just thought, Georgia's got a lot of dumb drivers. So when I got home, my husband said to me, well, why don't you go beyond that and create a volunteer group on something you really care about? And so that's where I came up with the name, thinking, you know, how do I get a good acronym? And so I came up with that. Sounded a little bit like Mothers Against Drunk Driving.
No, it's fantastic.
We have since quit using that full name because I quickly learned. I went to a conference, at the time it was called Pro Bike, Pro Walk. I went to that and learned from some of the best experts, Dan Burden and Michael Ronkin, that road design is really the critical factor, that bad engineering breeds bad driving. And so I learned that it's so much more than just educating drivers. And so we no longer use our full name. I spend most of my time working with transportation professionals and elected officials, trying to move the needle on, you know, what innovative treatments are we going to put in at crosswalks, how much funding will be allocated towards pedestrian infrastructure, and then in the city of Atlanta, trying to get them to change their sidewalk maintenance program so that they will actually repair broken sidewalks. Many of those are, the ones we have, are over 100 years old and in terrible condition. That's why we don't use our full name. We still do distribute educational materials, work with the police, but it's been hard. When you get in the suburban areas, it's very hard to make much of a difference through engineering or traffic enforcement. And I know other places like Sweden have just given up on those, and it's all about redesigning the roads.
I wanted to ask you about that before we got into the design, because the driver education is something that to me was different than what I'd seen before. And we actually had a pretty funny, I say funny from my perspective, but it was serious op-ed here in Minnesota a couple of weeks ago from a psychologist who diagnosed the problems with congestion and pedestrian fatalities and some of the other traffic-related problems we were having as a psychological problem. And his proposed solution was that we needed comprehensive driver re-education. It made me laugh because it was kind of, you know, that was his silo. And so that was how he viewed things. But I'm interested to hear your take on driver education and maybe why you started with that and why you went away from it ultimately.
Well, the best thing that we did that educated drivers, I think we really transformed things when we got the city of Atlanta to start installing in-street crosswalk signs. I do feel like in Atlanta, drivers did not know that pedestrians had the right of way. Many times I heard people say things like, you know, when are we going to get Georgia to give pedestrians the right of way? You know, when I've been to California, drivers stop. And I would tell people that we do have the right of way. It's just people don't know it. But when we got the city of Atlanta to install the in-street crosswalk signs, these are put in the middle of the road.
Is that like the sandwich board kind of signs?
Well, they're narrower than that. They might be 1 foot wide. They're on a rubber stand.
Yeah, yeah.
And they go up about 2.5 feet maybe.
Sure.
And they say state law stop for, well, some of it are stick figures. Like there's a little stop sign and then four and a stick figure of a pedestrian. And it says in crosswalk. It may even have the government code or law code number. But we got the city to put a few in. They were willing only to do it as a pilot project, so at two locations. And then people saw them and they wanted them other places. And city of Atlanta, the public works person, was resistant at first because she said, well, what if they work? Then everybody will want them. Well, they did work and they have spread. I think there's at least 70 locations with these. They do require a lot of maintenance because they get hit by turning cars a lot, but they are extremely popular. And the biggest impact was it was like an education campaign. It's like putting small billboards everywhere. And it did really change driver behavior. In Midtown with a higher density and downtown, also higher density, there's Georgia State University, so you get a lot of people walking. And there is, among drivers, the expectation that there will be pedestrians and that they do need to stop. So there's been a huge change in driver behavior. I think that has been one of our biggest impacts. It's been hard to get the police to dedicate much time to the enforcement. I know in New York City and some other locations, they are really stepping up the police enforcement. Here, the biggest safety problem is in the inner suburbs. We've had a lot of transit-dependent people move out to the suburbs, and that's where the fatal crashes are occurring. More people get hit in the city of Atlanta, but it's less likely to be fatal. With our efforts to get the engineering changes, a lot of that is in the inner suburbs, that getting things like the hybrid pedestrian beacons, and this gets kind of wonky with the rectangular rapid flash beacons, but there's a lot of things that can be done to make these roads safer. There's really multiple approaches. Part of it is making the most dangerous places not as bad, and then there's also the focus on making the pretty good places into great places. And so you look at it both ways, that there are parts of the region in the more urban areas where you could really have a great walkable community. There's other places where you've got low-density development, cul-de-sacs feeding onto high-speed arterials, where the best you can probably do is making it not so bad, not so dangerous. And we work on both.
Okay, let's transition over to design. I'd like to hear some of the challenges that you've faced, because we run into people all the time who will send us their strode photos and send us their kind of nasty intersections and say, you know, what do we do here? A lot of times, you know, we're left kind of scratching our heads going, I'm not sure what we do. Tell us some of the success stories you've had with specifically challenging places that you've had to deal with there in Atlanta.
Well, one of the things that I think in the past couple of years we have successfully pushed, there haven't been enough installed yet, but we've overcame resistance to bin block crossings. Buford Highway has a nationwide, I think, reputation as the worst road for pedestrians, perhaps in the whole country. It is 7 lanes wide. A lot of people who are immigrants, multiple languages on this road, a lot of transit on the road, and a lot of fatalities. And when people would get struck and killed, the media representative for the Georgia DOT would talk about, you know, our goal or our desire is for people to walk to the intersections where it's safe to cross. Well, the intersections are often a half mile or more apart, and it's completely unrealistic to expect anybody to walk that far. And the intersections themselves are extremely dangerous. Many of them are skewed, coming in at an angle to the other one, a lot of turning cars, drivers not expecting pedestrians. And what we've successfully done is get them to support and install mid-block crossings. They've done some of these with the hybrid pedestrian beacons, otherwise known as HOC beacons, and they are so much safer to cross at. You don't deal with turning cars. And just having that island there, even if you didn't have that beacon, you're dividing the road up, or you're crossing into two sections. You're just dealing with one direction of traffic at a time. And we've really won a lot of support for these. They're also the cheapest intersection or the cheapest safety improvement. And one of the things we're really emphasizing is a lot of low-cost improvements is a lot better than a small number of expensive improvements. And so we are encouraging the median islands, you know, saying you can come back later and do more, but don't like the perfect, be the enemy of the good. That's still a big fight, because we had a road that would definitely qualify as a strode. It's 6 lanes in Atlanta, and it had a road diet, I think, last fall. And they took it down to 2 lanes in each direction, with most of it a two-way center turn lane. Part of it just went down to 4 lanes. And they put in bike lanes and wiped out the crosswalks at 8 intersections. They're planning to put in 3 refuge islands with the hybrid pedestrian beacons, but they have no plans to put in any safety treatments at the 8 intersections where they remove the crosswalks. The federal guidelines do discourage having crosswalks on their own on wide roads that have more than 3 lanes, more than, I think, 12,000 cars a day. This road has 37,000 cars a day. And so at these intersections, pedestrians do have the right of way, but just removing the crosswalk is not a solution. What the federal guidelines currently say is you're not supposed to put the hybrid pedestrian beacons at intersections. They need to be at least 100 feet away. And I participated in a national conference call it's called Focus States and Cities. These are the ones with the worst pedestrian fatalities in the country. And Charlie Zegear, who's one of the leading experts, if not the leading expert, on those kind of research questions, he said, go ahead and put the hybrid beacon at these intersections, that what's in the Manual of Uniform Traffic Control Devices is just a guide or a recommendation. It's not a rule. And he said that's going to be going away in the next version of that guideline. California has already changed their state manual to say it is okay to put them at the intersections. And so we are encouraging Georgia DOT to go back in and not be afraid of just because it's a guideline, you can't go beyond it. And definitely one of the biggest problems is this feeling among the transportation professionals that if it's not perfect, we could have liability if something happens. On that road, at the side streets that are not signalized, there are signs that say no left turns. But when you're asking for median islands, the transportation engineer said, well, that would block people from making lefts out of their driveways. And I said, well, they can go around the block, you know, turn right. And so a lot of the challenge is getting the transportation professionals to understand the importance of these issues, the safety issues. One of our best strategies is getting people out walking with us, really observing the traffic and being more creative. One of the things we did about 5 years ago was we got our transit agency, MARTA, to basically lend us a bus and a bus driver. We went out to one of the five-lane roads. I gave a presentation, and then the transportation professionals got on the bus with us. We would let them off the bus in groups of three at different locations, and they had to cross the street at locations. This area was a mile between crossings, and they had to experience what it was like crossing the street like that, five lanes, high speed, and it really changed things. It got the transportation operations person who attended, because after that, I think it was actually Michael Orta who worked with us who gave the first presentation, and then I gave the one about how do we pay for it? What's the solution? And after that meeting, Kathy Zahol of Georgia DOT, she changed how the Highway Safety Improvement Program funding would be allocated. She made it so that they would allocate it according to share of crashes of each transportation mode. And at that time, pedestrians accounted for 10% of the fatal crashes. Now we're up to 17%. And that's primarily because the number of crashes has gone up significantly, fatal crashes for pedestrians, but the number of fatal crashes for motor vehicle occupants has gone way down and has less to do with better driving than with people having seat belts and airbags and getting to hospitals quicker.
Sure, sure. It's always frustrating for people when they find out that we as engineers prioritize things based on when people get killed. And there is kind of a perverse incentive where, you know, if you want action, someone's got to die. And that's such a frustrating thing, especially, you know, as a local advocate, because you're trying to prevent those kind of things from happening. I'm interested to explore more the either resistance or support, and hopefully the latter, that you've gotten from engineers and engineering departments. And I want to give you a little story that I ran into here in my hometown. We have a nasty strode that was built in the middle of a neighborhood. Used to have a two-lane road with parking on both sides. They took out the parking, made it a three-lane with a center turn lane, and put in some just huge curb radiuses on this one intersection where there's a lot of pedestrian traffic. We went out last summer and installed just some flags for people to carry across when they were going across this intersection. We were looking at saying, we don't have any money. What's the cheapest thing we can do? We'd seen people do this before, and we wanted to study it and see how it worked. Worked great. People started using them. I got a call from one of the engineers, you know, can we have lunch? We went out to lunch and he said, you've got to take the flags out. Well, why do I have to take the flags out? Because you're encouraging more people to walk. Yeah. And you're encouraging people to use the intersection, and that's going to create more conflicts and more accidents. We don't want that to happen. I was a little taken aback because obviously people walk here. As an engineer, you should be anticipating that. But, you know, his reaction was they've got to go because they're creating a safety problem. Tell me how your advocacy has been received by engineers, and hopefully how that has gotten better over time as you've kind of done more and more and more of this.
I think there's several things. One is that Federal Highway Administration, one of their goals is to increase the number of people who walk and bike. There's a recognition that walking is important for health. And so what the Center for Disease Control and Prevention has been pushing is more walking. The Surgeon General this year is doing a call for action on walking. promoting the health benefits of walking. There's also a lifelong communities program at the Atlanta Regional Commission, really emphasizing the value of walking for seniors and trying to make sure people both have a way to have transportation and also not be isolated. So I think emphasizing that the roads are for all users is important. And I think in my case, because I can't drive, I've been able to speak repeatedly at meetings and use myself as an example of how, because I can walk, you know, I still have an independent lifestyle. And so we have talked about the fact that 30% of people do not drive, or maybe more than that. I think if you're including children, I'm not sure, but we have a lot of poverty. Where we've made a really big difference in getting the Atlanta Regional Commission to recognize that walking is not just local, it has a regional significance, is when the Atlanta Regional Commission did a comprehensive study of the transit system here. Where are people going? They did a lot of surveys, both on the buses and the transit stations. Where are they going? What's the purpose? And how did they get to transit? And how are they going to get to their destination after they get off? And they found that 72% of transit trips start with walking, 80% end with walking. And for low-income people, the share was even higher. And so that showed the importance of walking. It led to the creation of what our Atlanta Regional Commission refers to as Last Mile Connectivity Program, where they're allocating $12.5 million a year to projects that complete the trip from transit, either to or from, and that's helped fund the safety improvements near transit stops or stations. In terms of the walking, we've had some similar feedback from schools, and I know that's nationwide where they don't want the kids to walk to school because it's dangerous. But I think you just need to give examples of people who have to walk. There's no choice. But also just the health benefits, the fact that it's relaxing. It's, you know, we have an obesity epidemic, and walking is something everybody can do. It's cheap. You need no equipment. But you do need a safe environment. And so it's absurd to say we don't want people to walk because it would create more conflicts. I mean, get people to quit driving and there'd be no conflict.
That brings me to one of the things that is on your website that I think is starting to percolate around the country. And that is this idea that we need to slow traffic down. As an engineer, I'm kind of programmed, and I've had to deprogram myself to think that the goal is to speed traffic up and to make it move more quickly. But you guys are advocating, let me get the exact words that you use. You say, kill speed, save lives.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that initiative and the thinking behind that?
There's actually a movement in a lot of cities to get even slower speeds, get their cities to have slow zones with 20 miles an hour. I think that's going on in London also. But if you get hit as a pedestrian, if you get struck at 20 miles an hour, there's only a 5% chance that the crash will be fatal. If you get hit at 30 miles an hour, it's a 45% chance of death. And if you get hit at 40 miles an hour, it's an 85% chance of death. So the faster the drivers are going, the higher the risk of fatal crashes and serious injuries. Reducing the speed is really important. We have engaged a lot of neighborhood organizations. We've distributed, I think, 8,000 yard signs. The initial one said, kill speed, not kids, and we got a little flack for that. Kill speed, save lives. The neighborhood associations have been great partners. People in residential areas are most concerned about the speeding. That's where kids are. Something like that is not going to work on a strode, but it will work on a two-lane street really well. And then we've also distributed flyers that use images showing the risk of death at different speeds. And it has raised awareness, but in order to slow people down, it does take changes to the road too. That one of the most effective ways to get people to slow down is with speed radar signs that tell people how fast they're going. You know, improved suspension in cars, I think, has made people less aware that they're speeding. They feel safe. I took a cab once on the street where I live, and I mentioned the street's wide enough for horse and buggy side by side with cars, and the taxi driver was going down my street. I saw he was going 40 miles an hour. I asked him to slow down, and he said, this is safe, don't worry. And I said, well, what about the people outside your car? And so it takes education.
Right.
my philosophy on taxis is that I won't give them a tip if they drive like jerks.
That's awesome.
And then the ones that drive well, I will thank them for it and give them a bigger tip.
So. Yeah, yeah. You mentioned transit earlier. You know, Atlanta is not known for its transit, but it does have some transit lines that are there. And I was in San Antonio a few weeks ago, and very, to me, kind of similar landscape in many ways. Mm-hmm. Some really nice walkable parts of the city, but the vast majority of it was really difficult to get around. They were talking about some large-scale transit improvements. And one of the comments that I made was that, that's great, more power to you, but you can't even walk to your existing bus stops. You can't even get across the street to get to the bus stop you have now. Without doing all those supporting things, how is a transit system going to be really viable? Can you talk just a little bit about the relationship between good pedestrian infrastructure and successful transit?
Absolutely. The Safe Routes to Transit Initiative is really our top priority. It's one of our biggest programs, and we developed Safe Routes to Transit toolkits that were really guidelines on what crossing treatments to provide at transit stops. The Walk Boston, which is a similar organization to ours, one of their, I don't know if you'd call it slogans or what, but it's basically a crosswalk at every bus stop. Well, Boston's a lot different than Atlanta. We're not expecting a crosswalk at every bus stop, but we would like every bus stop to have a safe crossing possibility. In some places, that may just be a median island. In other places, it may mean moving the bus stop. We have some bus stops that are located in places where pedestrians can't see far enough to know if a car is coming, like over the hill. And so we want those moved. Other places, especially where there's a two-way turn lane, we want the median islands there. There's where you've got a higher volume of pedestrians, do more than that, put in the rapid flash beacons. But in transit, what you're going to get with a bus system, you're going to get the people who have no other choice walking to transit, putting their lives at risk, but you're not going to get other people who have the opportunity to drive to switch to using transit. I think what we're trying to do with the Safe Routes to Transit Initiative is to help those most at risk, but also to encourage others to use transit, to make it safe enough that people will make that choice. In Atlanta, once you're inside the city, there's much better access to transit, especially, well, I live very close to the north-south transit line, which is the most frequent. There's an east-west one that goes to the city of Decatur. It's just very walkable. And both those lines, if you live close to it, it's actually very efficient transit. What is inefficient is the transfers that we used to have prior to the heavy rail. We had bus stops that took you directly to your destination. What we have now is that all the bus stops feed into the trains. And so you might have to both transfer to a train and then transfer to another bus. And it becomes incredibly slow. With the recession, we had big cutbacks in our bus service, and a bus that used to start at the transit station closest to my house then moved to the next one. So I had to walk, you know, half a mile to get it, and it went every 40 minutes instead of every 30. It became a lot slower to get over to Emory University. When you don't have frequent headways, basically how long you have to wait for getting a bus or a train, it is very inefficient and people won't choose to use it. But the safe crossings is really important too. That transit works well for me in part because I am willing to walk a mile or a mile and a half to get to my destination rather than wait for a bus. So I'll take rail and then walk the rest of the distance. But if you're not in the urban parts of the region, that's really not possible. The importance of the safe crossings is the most important one, that if there's dirt on the side of the road that you can walk on, it works for people like me unless it's muddy. It doesn't work for people with disabilities, so we do need the sidewalks, but I think the safe crossings are even more important.
It's always been a little bizarre to me that we would spend $1 billion on a transit line and not spend the additional $2 million or $3 million around every stop, making the stop actually walkable within, say, a 6-block or 12-block radius. That seems like a bad investment. if you're trying to make an investment in transit, you're leaving a lot on the table by not making that next kind of small increment of investment to support the larger investment.
I think you're absolutely right on that. And it wouldn't even cost a few million. It would cost a lot less than that. And especially for the crossings, people expect to cross the street where they get on or off the bus. And so putting in a safety improvement, if it's something like an island, it'll cost perhaps $25,000. If it's something like the hybrid beacon, it might cost $80,000 to $100,000. That is very cheap compared to the cost of building and operating a system. And the same is true for buses. That I think what's more important than the mode of rail or bus, you know, transit, buses work fine if you don't have to transfer. Having a dedicated space where you're not in with traffic is very valuable. We're going to have a streetcar opening soon downtown. The rails for it are in the road. It will be interesting to see how well that works, that if it's congested, it may be quicker to walk.
Sure.
That I know on Peachtree Street, which is our main street and where our office is, at rush hour, I can walk faster than people can drive. You know, I hope that the light rail that's being put in does work. I think the reason the heavy rail is liked here is that it's not mixed in with traffic.
Right,
that
right.
I do think bus rapid transit can succeed also if it's got its dedicated space.
Let me ask you this. I'm not going to be upset if the answer is no, but I'm interested to know if any of the kind of financial arguments are helping you more now today than maybe they were pre-2008. If some of those are essentially, you know, ace cards in your deck where, you know, before maybe they weren't. And I'm kind of getting into the strong towns take here too a little bit, where we make a social argument and we make a cultural argument. And I think you make a really strong user argument that, hey, there's people who don't have the option to drive who really need this. Is the financial part of this, the fact that we literally are going broke building highways and have to do something different, is that something that is becoming a more powerful tool for you? And if so, how?
I'm not sure we're there yet.
Yeah.
We're not seeing a shift in the amount of money that's allocated. That with the last regional transportation plan, they came up with all these different levels of sifting through to figure out what would be the priority projects. And before going through all these levels, they, because they knew on a lot of those that the pedestrian infrastructure couldn't compete in terms of how much congestion it would relieve or some of their other priorities. And so they separated out the pedestrian and the bike and came up with a lump sum for those. I don't know if it was that they couldn't, thought it wouldn't compete. They wanted to allocate a certain amount, I think, to maintenance and then a certain amount to congestion relief. And I know somebody with the Livable Communities Coalition at that time was saying you ought to go through that sieve first and then figure out the money for pedestrians. And so they're still separating us out and giving funding. I think it's more on the safety issues and definitely the economic ones. The Livable Centers Initiative has been a very popular program. A lot of the smaller cities and towns really want that money, and there have been a lot of planning studies with that. I think what's helping now is the business community really recognizing the value of the more walkable places. There's the growing demand from young people. I think that's making a big difference, that students, after they graduate from college, are wanting to live in town. More of them are biking and using transit. And then older people moving back into the city. I think all of those are helping. I don't think that the lack of funding is shifting money over, because what I'm hearing more at the planning meetings is we're going to focus on better traffic operations, which usually means long green times for the drivers on the major arterials, long wait times for pedestrians to get across the street. So I think that's one way that the worse economic situation for transportation is making things worse.
Yeah. How helpful or not is the MPO in Atlanta? Do you deal with them at all?
Oh, yeah. That's what I refer to as the Atlanta Regional Commission. That
okay.
is our MPO. And they are definitely helpful. They're the ones that came up with the $12.5 million a year for the last mile connectivity program. They also, with the transportation alternatives program that's in the current federal bill, they allocated, well, all of it did go to either walking, biking, or shared use paths. Their two priorities were the safe crossings or safe access to transit. The project they selected was that, and they want a network of regionally connected trails. I'm not thrilled with that idea because I don't think anybody, I know nobody is going to walk across a region that spreads 100 miles from north to south.
Right.
And, you know, even a marathon runner is not going to do that. And cyclists, you know, maybe for a century ride might do 100 miles, but I think more important is having the trails where people really are and where they want to go. Having long regionally connected ones is not the key thing. It's connecting.
Let me stop you there because I want to give you a chance to elaborate on that. And I want to ask it to you like this, because we run into places all the time that when they talk about pedestrian infrastructure, my hometown here in central Minnesota, when we talk about pedestrian infrastructure, they think recreational trails.
Right.
And for them, it's all about, you know, how do we get the regional corridor, the rails to trails program? There's a place for recreational trails, but that is different than what you're talking about in a significant way. Can you just describe the way that it's different?
Well, my focus has been primarily on pedestrian infrastructure and policies that relate to transportation. Enabling you to get to transit, to get to shopping. It can be recreational. I really do enjoy walking on our main street, window shopping, or it can be fun, walking to dinner and having a conversation. Certainly the trails are very popular. We have a very innovative project under construction called the Beltline, which is connecting about 50 neighborhoods. It's got probably about 4 miles of trails or five built so far. One of them is just packed with cyclists and pedestrians on the weekend, but it is connecting several neighborhoods. It's a shortcut because it's in an angle connecting some very positive places. Piedmont Park is our biggest park, and then it goes to a new park in the old Fourth Ward, and it's in an area that's one of the densest parts of the city. And that's really popular. And it's going to go around. I think the trails will total 32 miles, but that's different than a regionally connected trail. That's 32 miles in the denser part of the city. Out in the suburbs, I could easily see a trail that connects from a neighborhood to a retail center, but whether it goes from that county to another county really doesn't matter. And so I think trails definitely can be useful for transportation too. One of my coworkers rides his bike to work and uses that Beltline trail, and it is much safer than being in the road, or definitely the Strode type roads. And so they can be both, but one of the issues I have with these recreational trails is they're presented as both bike and pedestrian. And for a long distance one that's connecting things that are miles apart, it really isn't for pedestrians. Maybe for runners. People will go a few miles, but more for recreation. They're not going to walk, most people, 3 miles to work. I would certainly walk a mile and a half, or maybe occasionally, you know, like a couple times a year, 3 miles just to do it. But I don't think it's realistic for transportation. I do think recreation is important, though, and encouraging physical activity. The fact that the trail is popular, it's getting a lot of people out there being active, having fun, and these are people who might work far away from where they live. So it's definitely healthy. But it's a question of how you're spending your money.
The last thing I want to ask you is really about Atlanta. And okay. Atlanta has a national reputation as being one of the more decentralized, auto-dependent kind of places that there is. How optimistic are you about Atlanta and Atlanta's future?
I'm optimistic in part because of really changing attitudes among young adults of wanting to live in the more urban environment, being comfortable with multifamily housing, supporting transit. I don't think the region as a whole is going to become walkable. I think there are going to be real issues with older people. A lot of the older adults are living in suburban areas. I think they're going to have a tough time. There's a phrase you hear all over the country of aging in place. I think that really needs to change. Maybe aging in your community, but not on your cul-de-sac. And, you know, I hope that attitude changes. I hope there's more education about the benefits of living in a, you know, in a small town. I don't think people who live in a cul-de-sac are going to move to downtown Atlanta, but I could easily see them moving to an activity center if they can afford it. A lot of the new urbanist kind of development is very expensive. So I do hope we can have more affordable housing. That's very one true. Of the key things to making Atlanta successful. Likewise, better schools. A lot of people move to the suburbs because of the quality of the schools there. I'm optimistic, but it's hard to say. Our state is not supportive of transit. It's one of the only cities in the country with a large transit system that is not getting state support. That may be changing. They, a year or so ago, approved a bill that is providing state financial support to the regional bus transit. And so if they're supporting the regional transit but not the urban transit, there's an issue there, and hopefully somebody will press them on that to get more financial support for our MARTA system, or maybe that will become the regional. There's a lot of talk about that and changing its name, becoming a regional transit system. Mixed feelings about the future.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that. Sally Phlox, I want to thank you for being on the podcast. People can get a hold of you. I know your website is peds.org, P-E-D-S.
That's correct.
.org. You've got a blog there, which is...
We do, yes. My coworker, Ian Sanson, writes most of that.
Yep. And we link to that.
Our newsletters are there too. People can go to our website and subscribe to our newsletter, which is monthly. We also have a Facebook page, although Facebook is getting tougher to reach people.
Sure.
On that.
What is the best way to get a hold of you?
To get a hold of me, my email is Sally, S-A-L-L-Y, @peds.org. Also, they can call 404-685-8722.
You guys are doing really great work, and it's inspirational, and it's fun to see, and I've enjoyed spending time on your website, and I've enjoyed chatting with you as well. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it. Thanks.
Yep, thanks. And everybody out there, thanks for listening, and keep doing what you can to build a strong town. Take care.
They know that America's one big pothole right now.
Chuck Marrone, this has been fascinating.
The United Nations Earth Summit. Agenda 21. Yeah.
The next time it happens, it'll be bigger than the Fed. The Fed did truncate the disaster the last time. I mean, they did. These other banks would have failed. They didn't. So you have to give the Fed credit for truncating it. Although I'd like to say, you know, this cult of Bernanke is hero. To me, he's a guy who sets your house on fire and then shows up with a fire hose and offers to put it out. I don't give much credit for being a hero in a disaster that he caused, he and others. But it will be bigger than the Fed, because all the policy that I described, that $4 trillion approximately of money printing, is still there. So what happens the next time there's a liquidity crisis of the kind we had in 2008? Except, you know, using my analysis, my dynamic, systems analysis, it'll be much worse. So now you have a worse liquidity crisis than we had in 2008. The Fed did everything I just described to put out the last one. That's still there. What are they going to do next time? Print $8 trillion, $12 trillion? There is some, there actually is not a legal limit, but there is some confidence limit or political limit on what they can do. And that crisis is going to be bigger than the ability of the central banks to snuff it out because they've all trashed their balance sheets.